Thirun Sarnai. And today you will have the extra entertainment. So we'll have many cheers. I will think that it is for the sermon. Usually you're very quiet. I get hardly more than a nod of approval from you, but I don't get much more. But today we have a whole fanfare. Applauses and whistles and cheers and all that. So I'm going to assume that that is for the sermon. What are you going to do? Yes, you're going to have to try and focus. You're going to have to try and focus today. This is the way it is. There's a saying, something one of my mentors taught me, and I was very fortunate to come across that mentor. He's the one who, when I first started my employment, soon after university, I had the good opportunity to join a graduate program while I was in the UK with a top bank at the time. And my first manager also was my mentor. And I was very fortunate. He was a South African gentleman. This mentor, he taught me how to plan my life. He taught me about managing my workload. He taught me about setting goals. He taught me about working smart, not always working hard. He introduced me to a lot of the positive thinkers, contemporary positive thinkers. You know, the likes of Zig Ziglar and all that kind of thinking. Brian Tracy, these are popular names in that arena. So he introduced me to a lot of that really good stuff that took my life on a completely different path. It was actually a complete change of trajectory at that point. And one thing he taught me then, and I remember to this day, it has kind of been my mantra, particularly in challenging situations. He said, never wish it was easier. Always wish you were better. What do you think about that? Yeah. Never wish it was easier. Wish you were better. Sagacious words, aren't they? Very wise words. Because it shifts the focus of the situation from the external to the internal. It puts you in the driving seat. It puts you in control. It puts you in command. It empowers you. It teaches you that in any situation, you can take charge. And for better or for worse, whatever outcome is determined by what you do next. So today we have a similar situation. We can all either hope that it was better, so then we can go and have a talk, have a chat with them and say, Puta, can you keep it down? There's a sermon going. Or let's try and be better. Today you're going to have the opportunity to listen to the Dhamma and apply the Dhamma both at the same time. So I've been giving you swimming lessons, but you were always on the bank. Today you're going to have to jump into the water. Yeah. So you're going to have to jump into the water and listen, take lessons at the same time. So you have your instructor with you, not to worry, not to fear. So as I teach you about sound, and we talk about anicca, And then we get the applause, which is of course for the sermon. What my mentor taught me changed my life. There are many lessons that he taught me. I mean, I've been very fortunate to always have the best teachers. No matter where I go, in whatever situation, circumstance I find myself, I've always had the good fortune of, I don't know what it is, must be my lucky stars. But today I understand that it has to be merit. Nothing else. Any comfort, any good, anything wholesome we enjoy in our lives is down to the good merits that we do. And I think I have always been that one, at least in my recent past in samsara, where whenever someone came up to me with a problem, I don't think I always had the answer, but I think I always pointed them in the right direction. That must have been the merit. If I'd always had the answer, then today I'd be the teacher. But that was not my paramita, not to be the teacher. It wasn't to be the teacher. It was to be the, not to be the best teacher, but to be the best student. That was my paramita. So how do I sow that? Or how do I reap that? That's what I sowed. It must have been. You can look back at samsara. Once you look at the present, you can work out your past from that. If you are lost now, what does that tell you about a turn that you took earlier down the road? You took a wrong turn. If you've arrived at the destination, then you took all the right turns. Am I right? So then when I look at the fact that in my life, I've always been so fortunate to come across the best teachers, people who are always so selflessly available and willing to give me their time and show me mercy and give me compassion. And whenever I had challenges and problems I had to overcome, always show me the right way and help me figure out the right solutions to those problems. It tells me one thing about my past. I must have always done the same. Like I said, I don't think I always had the right answers, but I think I always pointed people in the right direction, which, come to think of it, is what I'm doing today as well. I don't have all the answers for you, but I know where you can find them. That's why I keep pointing you in the right direction. And when you're ready, I hold you by your ear and then take you with me. As some of our visitors at the monastery have heard, and I have shared with you as well from time to time, you know, I hardly get any friends who visit me at the monastery because they know that I'm not available. And I have, wherever I had the opportunity, I've always shared with people, don't come to the monastery to see me, come to the monastery to see what I have seen. There's nothing special about me. I'm a very ordinary human being. What made me extraordinary is not me, myself, and I. It's what I saw. It's what was shown to me by those before me, by those who'd seen it before me, by those who guided me to see what I was supposed to see. So the same is of course true, and I think you are here for the same reason. You're not here to see me, are you? That's why you were happy last week when I wasn't here. I was told. Dhanagarika Mahathas told me and that Swaminathan said they were really happy to see Garo Maghahandru. And the queue was that long, Swami Nuhan sir. You only get like 5 or 6 people who come and talk to you, but that queue was the queue. There was a queue out the door, apparently. So of course, you know, I worked it out. I figured, you know, you're not here to see me, clearly. I was both settling and unsettling at the same time, but more settling than unsettling. I'm just jesting. But that is something I really do admire about this community. Sometimes I learn about some of you from other monks at the monastery. They come and tell me, Nayakandru, do you know there's this gentleman, do you know there's this lady who's been coming to your sermons for this very long, and they're very virtuous and they do this and they do that for the sasana. I'm like, really? I don't know much of the many of these stories. Excuse me. I frankly don't know a lot of your stories. I only know that you need and you want Nibbana. And that's enough for me. I know you want Nibbana. I know that you want to be free of suffering. That's enough for me. Who you are, where you've come from, who's who you are, who your grandparents are, what's your ancestral history. These are not things that are of a lot of value to me, certainly not in this context. What your profession is, whether you're wealthy or you're not so much, or whether you're even the president of the country. You should be here because you are looking for salvation. Because this is the environment for that. I have always and I will always treat you all the same. I don't think it is right of a mother or a father to look at her or his children differently. Look at one differently to another. Because then that is not altruistic love, it's selfish love. So I'm actually quite happy about the fact that you come and tell me about some of your problems sometimes. You tell me, Swaminas, I have these problems. Really getting on my nerves. I'm agitated, annoyed about this, or frustrated about this. I'm really suffering because of this. Please, could you help me? And, you know, if I have a minute or two, I'll give you a short answer. And I say, if you want a proper answer, come to the monastery. But I've always been very happy about the fact that. And I also tell our Swaminas at the monastery, I actually admire that as one of your qualities. Never has any of you come up to here and boasted to me about who you are. Sadhu Sadhu. You lot are amazing in that way. Never have you come up here and said, Swaminas, do you know who I am? Because if you did, actually, I've just been talking about who I am for the last 3 hours. What are you talking about, sir? That would be my response. Would it not? That should be the response. Do you know who I am? Yeah, I am the product of ignorance and attachment. That's what I am. But you've never, you know, on a serious note, you've never really come up here to me and said, I am this and that, I'm so and so, I'm connected to this person, I'm connected to that person. I'm this one's grandmother, I'm that one's grandfather, I'm this one's grandson, whoever. No one's ever come up to me and said that. I think one, you know that I won't entertain that. Because that is not what we're here for. We're here for our salvation. And secondly, I feel, correct me if I'm wrong, that you've been burnt far too many times. Because in many other circles, be that religious or non-religious, in many other places, I think people are far more interested in what they can get from you than what they can get for you. I said this to you the last time I spoke to you as well. I'm not here to figure out what I can get from you. I'm here to figure out what I can get for you. Because the reason The reason for that is, I have found everything I need in my life. I'm content. There isn't really anything that you can give me that will fulfill me. Physically, perhaps. Yes, I won't deny that. Physically, yes. But I'm not sure about tomorrow. I have zero confidence about tomorrow. Will I be alive tomorrow? Who knows? Therefore, if I've had a meal for today, then that's me done. Thank you. If I have something to wear and keep me safe from the elements, keep me warm for today, that's enough, because about tomorrow I'm not certain. If tomorrow comes, and it comes, and tomorrow I'll come to you again and say, may I have some, please? Do you have something to spare? And the Buddha has been so kind to us. He gave us a begging bowl. And he said, as long as you're not fussy about what you get, the universe shall provide. You know, they say there's no such thing as a free lunch. There is. As long as you're not fussy what you get. You should try Pindapatha sometime. Oh, but wait. You need an alms bowl for that. Last week I was at Mattegoda. The plan was to come do the sermon on Sunday, as I'd done before on previous occasions. But on this occasion, our Swaminarayanas were awfully kind to me. And they say, they came and asked me, Swaminarayan, it's not very often you get this opportunity to go on the meditation retreat, because you can only do it while Guru Handro is still at home. When he goes out to play, then you don't get the opportunity to leave the monastery at all. And I think he has a few trips planned out for this year. So when he's going to be going out again, then I'm stuck at the monastery. So while he's at home, they came and suggested to me, why don't you take the extra day and one of us will go and do the sermon. I said, but that's my sermon. That's the only thing I have to my name. But then after the sermon I got to hear the long queues out the door, piles of pirikara. So then I figured, I have nothing at all to myself. That's okay. I have your Nibbana. So Nibbana is what we're here for. Once again, I really admire the fact that, because I know there must be people here, you know, who probably own half of the country. They're probably business moguls here. Maybe really powerful figures in society, very educated individuals, and so on. And in fact, my ignorance about your context actually serves you well as well. And I'll show you how. It is sometimes possible when I talk about things, you know, I'm very gentle with you. I'm very gentle with you, aren't I? Yeah. I'm not harsh at all, am I? No, I'm not stern at all, am I? No, of course not. I'm very soft, very gentle. I only say the nicest things about you. Yes? Yes. See, because I don't know the ins and outs of your lives, it gives me the freedom, the liberty to speak so openly. Because I know deep inside that none of you will think that Swaminarayan is attacking me. I wouldn't anyway, because it's not in my nature to attack. I'm not here to attack. I'm here to save you from attack. But there could be first timers, there could be, they've only come a few times, and maybe the very first few times they've come here and they've spilled their entire life in front of me. And then when I start talking about topics which might seem a bit sensitive, if it starts touching a nerve with some individuals, at least until you have settled in and you have become a Rajagirian and you feel part of that community and you understand that you are a thread of this very fabric, because until then you feel like you're a speck of dust on this fabric, but that's not who you are. You're a thread in this fabric. You are what makes this community. But it takes a while for that conversion, that transformation to happen, does it not? I mean, you're all examples of that. You know, you came and you walked this path. When you first arrived here, you must have felt like a stranger. Don't we all? But after a few weeks, and the welcome and the reception and the soft words and the affection that you received from everyone, and as you got to understand the Dhamma, really, that was the key point. Once you understood the Dhamma, you began to understand the Dhamma, you realized, no. So all this stern words that Swaminarayan is throwing at us is only out of compassion. So once that penny dropped, then I was at liberty to speak to you. Even today, to this day, if I see a lot of new faces, I'm sometimes a little bit hesitant and a bit cautious because I don't want to upset anyone. That would defeat the purpose of my being here. But then when I don't know the ins and outs of your lives, then I can pledge ignorance. Can't I? So then you will know. No, Swaminarayan doesn't know about my life. He doesn't know that it was I who... He doesn't know that I have three wives and two girlfriends at the same time. So then surely he cannot be attacking me when he says this. So I don't know whether you left your parents in care homes. So that means it's a free topic for me to talk about. What I think about it. What the Buddha has said on that matter. But if you revealed all of that with me, then I would have to be very cautious about what I say for fear that it might, you know, touch a nerve. Yes, indeed. So I think in this context, I think it serves you well as the sermon itself, that you look at the Swaminarayan here as a teacher. And maybe not as a friend. But once I'm done with the sermon, I mean, I'm a very average person. I really want you to accept that. And I'm not just saying this out of humility. I'm a very average person. I have my flaws. I have my weaknesses. I'm aspiring to be a better man every day. My aspiration is to fulfill my journey in this lifetime. I'm not perfect. That's why I need a teacher. That's why I need Noble Association. That's why I spend my life every day, every waking hour in Noble Association with my teachers and my noble friends. That's why I do merit work, because I need to fulfill my paramita. That's why I contemplate, because I understand that I'm not complete, I'm not full, I'm not perfect. So just as you, I'm the same. I'm a very average person. It's the Dhamma that's extraordinary. So, as long as we are all here for the Dhamma, and we're all here for healing, this is healing with feeling. That I'll give you. This is not a lecture. This is an invitation to be part of the community. But as long as you understand that, and you're here not with just your head, but also with your heart, and with your hands to serve, heart to feel, head to be intellectual and contemplate the Dhamma. If you're here with all three of them, I think a lot of things, good things will happen to you. Let's get started then. Let's bring our palms together to make our reverential obeisance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. As we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our respect, but this is a pledge of our allegiance to the destination, the journey and our practice. These three represent the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Let us then take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, observe the precepts, and we will then invite the countless sentient beings to join us and be amongst us. For this is an invitation to them to witness these meritorious deeds. And if there are any among them who are lacking in merit, the sight of this community and this meritorious unfolding will help them to rejoice in such merits and free from the woeful planes to be born in the blissful plane. May this serve them an opportunity to then listen to the teaching of the great master and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So that is what we will do now before we commence the sermon. Let us all chant the namaskar. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. We humans we are at the top of this intellectual hierarchy. There's no one as intelligent as we are. At least that's what we like to think. And God has been so kind to us that He's not put anything, any other species that we can see, it is visible to the naked eye, who may be or might be more intelligent, and therefore He's given us this opportunity to think that we are the most intelligent of them all. Because if there are other species, maybe devas, brahmas, who are more intelligent, maybe even wise, because there are those devas and brahmas who have attained noble states, and there are some brahma worlds that are only open to anagami brahmas. Aviha, Atappa, Sudasa, Sudasi, Akanitta. These are four brahmic planes that you cannot access unless you become an anagami, a non-returner to the karma world. Therefore, it's only once you have renounced your attachment to sensual desires will those planes be accessible. So then to get to those planes, you must have perfected your wisdom or developed, cultivated your wisdom at least to the point where you have understood that these sensual desires are meaningless. Yeah? So then for us human beings, as I said, God has been very kind to us that He has not placed them on this plane, and all we share this world with these animals, the Tirachaniyoni, the animal plane, the animal species, so we always feel like we are the most intelligent species. We are at the top of the food chain. Despite this, ladies and gentlemen, it's baffling, honestly, to see how we don't take a moment to understand the predicaments that we find ourselves in. I'll give you an example. And I'm actually going to make use of what's going on outside. Because as I was being driven into the to this monastery, I couldn't help but think, I'm always really analytical. It's a condition that I have, kind of a disease. I'm ailed by this disease, and therefore I'm always very analytical when it comes to things. So as I was driven in this morning, I was thinking to myself, we humans, because we are flesh and blood, muscles and bones, we need exercise. Absolutely, there's no question about that. Because if what is put in is not consumed, then it all starts piling up. And there are a few examples. I was one of them. Because I didn't know that that's what happens to the body when you just eat whatever you can get your hands on. I think I shared this story with you. When my family decided to migrate to the UK, and then it was just, everything was there. You could just feast yourself on so much, and then there was a time when I lost control. I was not obese, didn't get that far, because before then I got myself a medical checkup. And then the doctor said, if you don't start going to the gym, and if you don't start controlling your diet, then I can't give you very many years to live. So that was a shocker. If you ever have the misfortune to see any of my previous pictures of when I was a layman, just close your eyes as soon as you see it. It's that revolting, just the sight of it. The time of my life where I was so foolish. But then you will see that I was at least twice, maybe 1.5 times me, this what I am now. But that's the point I'm trying to get to here is, we human beings, we are flesh, muscles, blood, bones. Therefore, we have to eat what we are made out of. That's the only way we are made of anything. We have to eat what we are made out of. So all of our building blocks have to be consumed, eaten. And if we don't consume what we take in, the remainder is what is deposited. That's what remains. Everything else is burnt out. So then exercise is naturally something that we need. The thing is, if we go back a few decades, maybe sometimes even half a century, if not a little bit more than that, our people got their exercise from their daily livelihoods. Their lifestyle, exercise was part and parcel of their livelihood. People exerted themselves physically. Whatever they did for a living gave them the exercise they needed. And in that tradition, the tradition of Pindapatha is something I truly admire. Nowadays, we don't actually get that privilege, I have to say. See, the Swaminarayana gets his meal, and to get his meal, he has to do the exercise. Isn't that just wonderful, the way that it's all stitched together? So it's usually what do lay people do? We eat first and then we exercise. But what did the Buddha have us do? You first exercise, then you get the meal. So we had to take the alms bowl and go out walking. And then we got the meal at the end of the journey. So then, I think monks back then were much fitter than they are today. Generally, as a people, we were much fitter. Today, a lot of our fitness is only thanks to the medicines that we put into our bodies. Because half the time, the food that we eat is just half poison. It kills us at equal measure to it keeping us alive. I think these two things just go hand in hand. I might sound cynical, but that's not the point I'm trying to make here. I'm just saying things have changed so much. And what used to be a reflection and acknowledgement of the fact that we now have to exercise ourselves because we are born human and we have flesh, muscles, blood and bones. Later on, what happened was, when people's lifestyles started to change, ladies and gentlemen, as we started to urbanize, so this is not me pointing fingers at anyone, okay? I just want you to understand what's happened to us. Because we were not an urbanized people. We lived in the villages. We farmed. We cultivated. We worked. We didn't spend our days doing this or that. What's this? Typing on keyboards? That's not something we used to do. You see, look at this part of the world. It's a tropical region. Meaning, we get a lot of sun. And with sun, we get a lot of rain. That's how nature designed us. We were supposed to work with the sun and the rain and the soil. These three things were our friends. We were supposed to spend a lot of our time with the elements. But in some parts of the world, they don't have much sun. They don't have much rain. Therefore, it's understandable if they had to spend a lot more of their time indoors. We might think that this is all very random. It's not so random. Nothing is random. It's all cause and effect. There's our physiology, our bodies, our minds, we were all designed, our people, we were designed, your ancestors, you know, you are the descendants of your ancestors. Therefore, in that bloodline, in this culture, we were supposed to work, we were supposed to find ourselves outside, not indoors. Even schooling was done outside, not within the four walls of a classroom. It was supposed to happen under the mango tree, under the oak tree, with the teacher. And back then, students used to live with their teachers. That was called the Gurukul system. Today, children don't get to spend time with their teachers, neither do they get to spend time with their parents. Don't you agree? Because you kiss them farewell in the morning, because they're still asleep by the time you leave home. And then when you come back home again, they're asleep after a day's work. And the rest of the time they're at school. But the teachers don't take full responsibility because they say the parents are supposed to develop the child's values, attitudes and virtues and all that. And the parents don't take full responsibility of the child because they send the child to school. So it's the school who has to do that, because the child spends most of the time with the teachers. So what you have now is a tug of war. The teachers say that the parents should look after the child, and the parents say the teachers should look after the child. Did I just repeat the same thing? Did I? Right, for clarity, I'll say it again then. The parents say it's the teachers who have to take responsibility, and the teachers say it's the parents who have to take responsibility. But if you go back a few decades, that is not how it happened. The breadwinners of the family spent their youth with the teacher, and they learned everything from how to grow up, to be a man, to look after a family, to look after your community, not just the family, the community. There was a lot of value add going on there. So today, you know, there's a lot of talk about value-based education and all sorts. You know, from time to time, you see them in this new curricula. But back then, it was the way things were done. It was values first, education next. Today we just have education when you're trying to sprinkle a bit of value into it. Once again, I might sound cynical. The point is not that. I'm just stating a matter of fact. So, we were born into a part of the world, the tropical part of the world, and we were supposed to find ourselves outside. In fact, we were supposed to go to bed by around 8 o'clock to give ourselves a good night's sleep, because we worked hard. And not just the men, the women worked hard as well. They looked after the household back then, and they helped the husband, they helped the family. There was a lot of work to do. And it was not considered a chore. It was considered part of their contribution. Today, I think, you know, some places you have to pay the wife to do the chores at home. Maybe the wife has to pay the husband to go to work, to feed the family. It's all boiling down to that, unfortunately. And in some homes, you have to pay the children to get them to do any work. Wash the dishes and I'll pay you something for it. You know, you... Oh boy. They've even taken the merit out of that. You know, that is a meritorious deed. The child was doing something for their parents. A hugely meritorious deed. But now, what have the parents done? They say, no, I'll give you some money for it. Then go do the dishes. I won't do the dishes until I get paid. So the child comes to the mother at the end of the month going, right, let's balance the books now, shall we? Well, you owe me this much for washing the dog, this much for washing the car, this much for sweeping, this much for cleaning the cobwebs, this much for doing the dishes, right? So you owe me this much. Last month you paid me that much, there was a balance. So add interest onto that. So now it's become, it's no longer a family unit. It's a commercial unit. So you've taken the family out of the family. It's kind of like a bunch of strangers living together. You know, you change one thing for the worse, the whole thing begins to collapse, the whole thing begins to rot. It's like a vegetable. The entire thing doesn't rot all at once, does it? It starts in a very small place, and then unless you cut that bit out and throw it away, if you leave it there, in a few days, the whole thing will be rotten. And that's what's happened to us as a people, and it's happening at a rapid rate. I don't know whether there's anything that can be done about it. I have the liberty to speak to you, and I'm inviting you to do something in your own lives, in your own homes. I know I can't change a community, I can't change the world, but I can change your world. That is my intention with some of these things I say. So if you pay your children to do household chores, I implore parents to please reconsider. Don't take that merit out of your child as well. Don't steal them. Steal that opportunity to do some merits. It was not supposed to be done for commercial gain. It was supposed to be done for merit. Does that make sense, parents? So don't compensate your child by throwing them rupees and cents, by throwing them dollars and pennies at them. It's not what you're supposed to do. Teach them that there's something far more worth than that. Teach them the value of doing something good for your parents. Teach them the value of doing something good for society, to the family, for contribution. If you can, teach them that what you get in life is what you deserve, not what you desire. That's how we earn goodness, by spending goodness. These are the values that we have to instill in our children. We do a lot of them. At the monastery, our children do a lot of meritorious work. You will have seen them when you come into the monastery. Who plays the drums when we have Dakine or Perahara? It's our children. How much do we pay them? If you hired them, you've seen how well they play. Professional. If you'd hired them, you'd have to pay a lot. Do you think they come up to us and say, well, Swaminas, if you hired them, then you'd have to pay. So why not pay now? Maybe you pay half. They don't like that. Because, in fact, many of them don't even know what cash is. So if ever they have to leave the monastery, or if they want to leave the monastery someday, we'll have to give them a lesson on using money. They understand the concept of money, but they wouldn't recognize of... Actually, I can't remember what these notes are now. 5,000, do they still have it? Yeah. So they wouldn't recognize a 5,000 rupee note unless they learned it at school. But they don't know what one feels like, because they've not had the need to handle money. And you might think, sin, no. No, no sin. You just got the two words wrong. It's not sin, no, it's no sin. They're very lucky. They're very fortunate. They're so fortunate that they understand that you can't buy goodness. You can't go to a store and buy goodness. You can't go to a store and buy comfort. Comfort is a product of merit. That is what they have understood today, ladies and gentlemen. But that is not how we understood the world. We thought if you had enough money, then you could be happy. Am I right or wrong? That's what we all thought. Earn enough and enjoy life. But our children, this is not the philosophy that we are instilling in their minds. This is what they understand. Do good, get good. That's what they understand. So money has been strategically removed from their lives. We don't have to introduce money into that picture now. Therefore, there is no, how much do you have, how much does he have, how much does she have? No one's comparing. But even as children, if you have siblings and you get pocket money, now there's still competition. How much do you have? How much does he have? How come mommy give him more and not me? All that competition going on. I was talking about exercise. Exercise is something that we have to do because we are born human. We must understand that it is something that we've had to do. It's something we have to do. Not something necessarily we want to do. I mean, I wouldn't put myself into the category where I'm fanatic about exercising. I'm not crazy about exercising. I do it because it has to be done. Otherwise, you get all sorts of problems, health problems. But when we used to live with nature, exercise was part and parcel of our lifestyle. Then what happened? We started to urbanize. What was the root of urbanization? Or what is the root of urbanization? It's desire. People wanted more. When people wanted more, they had to congregate where there was more. And where more could be gotten easily. See, in the villages, don't they have food? Don't they have water? Cleaner food and cleaner water? Yeah? Yeah, of course. Today we drink our water out of tanks, chlorinated tanks. And these tanks, they are usually overhead tanks. Aren't they? Yeah. And so when you have an overhead tank, whatever minerals are there, they deposit at the bottom of the tank. And then where does the outlet come? Top or the bottom? On the bottom. So whatever minerals remain in the tank, these overhead tanks, they come out of the tap, and then that is what you consume. And we call it potable water. We use it in our cooking, we use it in our drinking, but we don't really have clean, pure water. Because all of it has to be pumped into our houses now. But back then, this was not the way that we did things. There was a well. And in a well, you don't take water from the bottom. What do? You take it from the top. Therefore, at the top was always clean, pure, fresh water. See what we did to ourselves? How clever we are. But then now there's so little square footage to go for everyone there, because we are all have to live together, and this is it's the urban lifestyle is very congested. There's not enough place or any enough room to keep digging wells. So there's one well, or they take water from the ocean or whatever, they treat it, and then it's pumped into these overhead tanks. And then they are containing plastic or near enough plastic vessels, constantly being heated by the sun. And usually what's the advice on these plastic bottles? It says on the label, these are not reusable. You're not supposed to refill these bottles. Use it once and dispose it. But we make tanks and we put all of our water into it. And we stock them sometimes for days, weeks, always consuming from the bottom of the tank. How intelligent we are. You've never seen cows do this. Urbanize themselves. Pump water up to tanks and drink that water. You've never seen them do that. Oh dear. Animals, you've never seen them do that. They always go to the fresh water sources and they take their water from that. But that's because they're stupid. Unlike us. We are very smart. People lived with flora and fauna. There was a lot of flora back then. But we started to urbanize. And today the only flora you have are these anthuriums and the chrysanthemums. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing these right. I don't have them now. It's not part of my life. Roses and the violets and all these. It's all for... It's sensationalism. There's no practical value in any of this. What good is having an anthurium plant at home? What's the practical value? But if you go back a few decades, people lived and at home, they had mango trees, they had coconut trees, they had a lime tree, they had a guava tree, they had a jackfruit tree. They had nature. Today we have concrete. Concrete is our nature. And although you don't know this, but people back then knew this, every natural product of nature emits its natural goodness. Even you emit something always to your environment. Every natural product of nature emits a natural source of its goodness. Therefore, when people lived at home, in the rural areas, or at least in the villages, and they had their furniture, they had their houses made out of clay. Today we have cement, but then back then this was all natural product. There was always a natural source of goodness. They were surrounded by that. So the trees at home, it had a natural healing power. And all you had to do was just go and sit down by the tree for a couple of hours a day. And all you had to do was put your feet on the ground. And the earth healed you. The earth healed you. Not you, them. Today, where are your feet? On tiles. The earth healed our ancestors. That's why they were fit. That's why they were healthy. That's why they didn't have to take pills like we do today to keep ourselves healthy. That's why they didn't die young. They lived a long and fruitful life. You know the old saying in Sinhala is what? When you bless someone, good life, ekasiya vissata, desiya vissak. That's what they say. Avada ayubo veva. Not 120, but 220 years of good luck and good health I wish upon you was a saying that used to be shared by people back then. Do you think today we can say that? Can you go up to your grandmother, your grandfather, or even your father and say, not 120, but 220 years I wish you good health and prosperity? Gone are those days. Very seldom do you hear of people living anywhere past, I think, even 90 now. Okay, 120 for you lot, but typically living up to 100 is now, it's a miracle. Living up to 100 is a miracle. And the thing is this, ladies and gentlemen, In this day and age, even if you lived up to 100, you wouldn't know what to do with all that life. Therefore, you know, it's fair enough that you die younger. It's reasonable. But back then, people had something to do with their lives. Their lives were purposeful. They knew the purpose of their lives. They knew that they were born to achieve something. Not a degree, not a PhD, not build a big house, not build something that was everlasting. That's why they built their houses with clay. And they had thatched roofs. Because they didn't build anything to last forever. Because they knew that was not what they'd come into this world for. But look at what we do today. We build our houses to last generations. There was only one thing they built back then to last generations. You know what it was? The temples. That was built to last generations. Not the houses, not the homes. Because people didn't invest too much time in materialism, in building up a material life. They didn't invest time in that because, and see, they had far more life than we did. We do. They had 120 years, if not more, and they still didn't invest a great part of that life building structures to last for generations. But today we have far less than that, and look at what we do with our lives. As soon as you get a job, the next thing on your mind is to get yourself a mortgage. So you can either buy a house or build a house. And you build it with the best of materials to last for how many generations? Because you want to pass it down to your children and then to their children and then to their children and then to their children. At least 3 or 4 generations is what we have in mind. I'll tell you why that is. Because in your mind, none of your offspring are supposed to go to the sasana. What are they all supposed to do? Live the same low, no, I mean lay. Live the same lay lifestyle as you did. Therefore, there was no plan, no hope, no desire that they would ever go to the sasana. Because if you knew that your grandchildren were bound for the sasana, then why would you build a house that was going to last 2 generations? Do you understand the contrast I'm trying to make here? I'm juxtaposing these 2 things with pure intention. I want you to understand. We took a wrong turn somewhere. That's why those things, you know, it's not because we didn't have the technology. Where did Sikri come out of? Today people are still marveled at how all that happens. They could irrigate water for kilometers, miles, all out of just natural power. How was that possible? To this day, scientists, engineers are marveled at how our ancestors built any of those things. You know, back then we had flying machines. But we think it was the Wright brothers who invented the first flying machine. Even before then, people didn't need flying machines. They could levitate themselves because their minds were so spiritually developed. You didn't need flying machines. Today you struggle with gravity, don't you? Gravity, sometimes we think of as a blessing. That's only because we don't understand this, where it all started. Why it is that we have gravity. For physics, you learn about gravity. You learn about gravity, not how it came into being. Would you like to know where it all started? Through the Dhamma, I can explain to you. We create the universe around us. We are the architects. Your mind is the architect of your immediate environment. And so when everyone thinks the same, the whole world is a product of our collective thinking. Does that make sense to everyone? The world is a product of our collective thinking. I like to propose to you that this gravity is not something that exists in the Deva worlds and the Brahma worlds. It's only something you have in the human world. And that is because of the our nature. It is not in our inherent nature to give a helping hand, to lend, to see someone better off than we are. It's in our nature to become better than others. Otherwise, tell me, ladies and gentlemen, why do we kill? Even if for food, why do we kill? Do you think devas and brahmas kill for food, for survival? No, but see how we are so prepared to kill for our survival. A life is a life. Pranagata is pranagata. This conversation is not about whether vegetarianism or non-vegetarianism is a choice. That's not what this conversation is about. This is not about eating. It is not about what you eat. It's about what you do to get that food ready. No other species, I'm talking about the 31 realms of existence, only humans kill for their survival. Animals do, but animals are also in this realm. See, they are also in this human world. Our animals are amongst us, aren't they? Your dogs, your cows, you're not your cows. You don't have cows. Those days you had cows. Go back 50 or so years, 100 years, 150 years, you had cows. Today we don't have cows. Today we have pet, cats and dogs and fish tanks, pet squirrels and pet hamsters and whatnot. They are also for aesthetic value. That is mainly what we keep our pets for aesthetic value. And because we want a companion. Because we feel so lonely. Especially when old age comes along and our children start leaving us. Then we need a companion. That's why they say, a dog is man's best friend. Because a dog never leaves you. Even if it's time for the dog to go find a female dog, he will walk around the town, find one. Once it's done, comes back home. Yeah? See, dog is very loyal. But humans are not like that. If they ever get interested in someone else, usually they're gone after that. Yet, who is the intelligent species? We are the intelligent species, so we say. So see, as humans, now intelligent, animals, just put them to a side for a second because they have zero intelligence to think about what's right or wrong. They have no sense of right and wrong. So put them to a side for a second. But as humans, of beings born in the Sukhati planes, the blissful plane, only humans do commit such sins, such as kill for survival. And we don't just kill for survival, we even kill for territory. Don't we? Don't we kill? Don't we murder for territory? Don't we murder for possession? I mean, murder is the worst of its kind, but there are from that to setting your eyes on something and wishing that they never had it and you did. From that to the worst kind of theft, it's all. The intention here is not to give, not to see someone else happy, but to have something for yourself at sometimes the expense of someone else. This is a very common trait. In fact, to be, try and get this the right way that I want to explain this to you. But to be human, although it's a birth in the blissful plane, to be human, by definition, is a desire to be better than others. To have a better position than others. To have a better situation than others. Now think about society for a second. Think about your workplaces. Think about the classroom. Think about what's going on outside. Isn't that competition? That's competition. What is competition? What is competition? What is the outcome of a competition? Victory. Who? For whom? For oneself. Victory for oneself. Victory for oneself suggests what for the other? Defeat. So victory for me at someone else's expense, someone else's loss. This is very human. Therefore, it's in our nature to try and oppress, suppress others for our gain. Does this not happen at the workplace, you tell me? Does it not happen at the workplace? Does it not happen in the classroom? Does it not happen at the village? Does it not happen at the auction center? This is what happens everywhere. Our gain at another's loss seems very normal to us. We give it a very nice name, competition. Our purpose should be compassion, but we have very conveniently replaced compassion with competition. That's what we have done. Now let me tell you how this is the source of gravity. The world around you is a product of your thoughts. You tell me, whenever you want to excel at something, if you want to come first in class, if you want to get the job, what is your intention for others? To lose, to fail, to come after you. If you are first, then they have to be second. If you want to be second, they have to be third, and so on. So it's always to drag them down. It's to drag them down. What does gravity do? Drag you down. Gravity drags you down. So much so that to just be upstanding requires effort. Just to stand up on your two feet, just to keep standing on your two legs requires exertion of energy. That energy you have to give yourself. That is why I say, this environment, everything from the grain of sand that rubs against your feet to this whole, what we call gravity that we take for granted, it was there when we came, that's what we think. When that apple fell on Newton's head, he just worked out the formulae to explain all that. But that only explains what was always already there. I'm asking you, where did it all come from? Where did it all start? What was the source of it? It is in our intention to pull others down, for us to excel, to be the better one. It is that what we always spread to this environment. It's always in our thoughts. It's embedded in the energy that we give off to the world. Whenever you have with every thought that you think, ladies and gentlemen, three things happen. Part of it goes to your karmic strand to determine what's due to come to you in the future. Another part of it goes to the upkeep of your body. It determines how your body functions. That's why when you think certain thoughts, your body responds. When you're angry, your body responds. When you're scared, your body responds. When you're lustful, your body responds. There's energy that is released through your chittas that decide and determine and control how your body works. And then the third component of that energy is released to the environment. That's why when there are good people, people who have wholesome thoughts, even when you walk into a place like that, you feel there's something light about the air. You feel, it's in the air. We can't put our finger on it, but we can sense something. It's there. And then when you walk into a room of people who are very vicious, vile, wicked, and all they have are such thoughts, those environments are not very pleasant. You feel very unpleasant. You feel very unwelcome. It's not always to do with the lighting. It's not that it's necessarily a gloomy place visually. It's a gloomy place. You can feel it. If someone asks you, how do you explain it? It's difficult to explain, but you can feel it. You can feel it because you're constantly interacting with that energy. After all, what are you? Are you human beings or are you just energy? You're energy. What are your thoughts? Energy. What is your body? Energy. So if mind and body are both energy, then energy must be responsive to energy. That is why I said, when our ancestors used to live in the villages, when they used to farm the paddy fields, when they used to live in homes made of natural things, then that was a very healing environment. When their bare feet always touched the ground, the earth healed them. But today, we don't have our bare feet touching any part of the ground. What do you always have on? Slippers and shoes. Hardly made of natural material anyway, as a, on top of all that. It's always made of some kind of synthetic material. So you want to put slippers on my feet? Don't you dare. I'm nature's baby. I'm nature's child. But we were, you know, if we had to wear shoes and slippers, then, you know, when we came out of the mother's womb, a pair would come out of it as well. Trust me. If you were supposed to have them. What, don't you think so? What, you think God made us incomplete? No, you have it. Then how come you have a backside to do your poo-poo? How come you have a digestive system to digest everything you eat? How come you have a mouthful of teeth to chew your food? Because you are born with everything you need. That's how the mind works. I've explained to you how your body was formed, hadn't I? I told you, when there's a necessity, then energy comes together. Energy comes together, and this coming together only stops once the necessity has been fulfilled. So your bodies are complete in that regard. Whatever the mind needed to survive in the human realm, you were born with. So you don't need shoes and slippers. But I think in this day and age, there are people who won't even think about setting their feet on the ground because it's yucky. It's ee and it's kaki. That's what they say. I wouldn't dare put my feet on the floor, on the ground. It's dirty. And what if I get dirt on my soles? You know, if you're wounded, if you have a wound, whatever, that's not what I'm talking about. You know, if you have cracked heels or whatever, and you have to keep it, you know, free of germs and dust and whatnot, that is not what I'm talking about. But as a healthy individual, you were born with everything you need. If we were designed such that we needed shoes and slippers to walk around, then I promise you a pair would pop out no sooner than you came out of the womb. Or it would grow on you as you were being breastfed by your mother. It would actually naturally grow on you if you needed it. That's why I say, you know, we have become so artificial. We've lost our naturalness. And then we wonder how come we don't have those long lives. How come we are so unhealthy? How come we have high blood pressures and what do you call this? Cholesterols and this diabetes. All these problems. And we wonder why. We wonder why we get all these knee pains and leg aches and all this and that. A lot of these knee aches is a result. At a young age, you know, people start developing these knee problems because we are supposed to walk on bare land, on bare soil, because the earth has a way of absorbing the shock of our bodies. Therefore, when you put your foot on the ground, the earth takes some of that pressure and relieves your body of that pressure. But when you live inside the house always, constantly on working on these tiles and whatnot, these things don't have that natural shock absorbing ability. Therefore, the pressure is always experienced by the brunt of it has to be borne by your knees. No wonder then your knees start giving in sooner than they were designed to. But look, think about your grandparents, or maybe their grandparents, you know, at 80, 85, they were doing household chores, no problem. They were cooking, they were cleaning, they went out to the farms, they were working. But today, by the time you are 30, 35, 40, knee problems, back problems. Back problems because we started sleeping on these artificial mattresses. That is not what our ancestors used to sleep on. They slept on natural things, either on the floor or on what you call this buru and the. And again, they were designed to absorb. They had a natural way of interacting with the body because it was all natural stuff. Nature was a product of your thoughts. So whenever the mind created something, it only created what it needed. But we are the most intelligent of them all. I'll tell you something to do if you want, right? At home, have a mirror. And when everyone's at home, like say you, your husband, your wife, your children, and the dog, walk up to the mirror and say, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the wisest of them all?" You'll see your dog's face in the mirror. Does your dog wear shoes? See, we were born with all the tools we needed to eat our food. Trust me. We were born with the tools we needed to mix our food up, break it down, and put it into our mouths. But what happened to us? We urbanized ourselves. We westernized ourselves. I'm not suggesting that what they do in that part of the world is wrong. That's not what I'm suggesting. Because what's there is how they're supposed to be. Let's leave it at that. But like I said, we are in a different climate. We're in different, the weather system's different, the climate is different, the geography is different. Pretty much everything's different. Only the color of the blood, of our blood is the same. Everything, even the color of our skin is different. If you needed cutlery to have your meals, don't you think as you popped out, like I said earlier, out of the mother's womb, you know, like these little packets they give in the, when you go on the flights, cutlery, they wrap it up in a little packet and then bring it to you. Don't you think, you know, if you needed cutlery to eat your food, when you came out of the mother's womb, a little packet would come out with that? And then a vanity pack or something? Why not? Why doesn't your body over time, there's a word for it. I can't remember, it's a biology term I learned a long time ago. It's when they specialize into certain, why does it not become a knife or a fork or a spoon over time? It's not, because this is what you're supposed to eat with. This is what you're supposed to eat with. One pan to make sure one end of the food pipe was good, the other hand to make sure the other end of the food pipe, not the food pipe, but the digestive system, was clean and fit. That's what I use also. But what did we do? We imported. We imported our cutlery. And then we brought in toilet paper. The body has its own natural healing system. We are designed to be a certain way, to live a certain way. My point is always this. It's not about what people do in other countries, in other parts of the world, and this is not me criticizing any of that. What I'm saying is what's right for them is not always what's right for us, and what's right for us is also not right for them. That's why the weather is different. That's why the geographies are different. It's designed a certain way. We can't live on Earth how Martians live on Mars, can we? We don't need oxygen masks, but if you lived on Mars, what would you need? If you lived on the moon, what would you need? You'd need an oxygen tank. So you just think, you know, why do we just westernize ourselves? Why don't we moonize ourselves? Because if you lived on the moon, you'd need an oxygen tank. Why don't we have that as well? Wouldn't that not be fancy? If all of us just carried, you know, a small oxygen tank with us, that'd be quite fancy, wouldn't it? Why did we just stop at westernizing? Let's all carry a mini oxygen tank with us. You know, just for class. Wouldn't that be nice? No, this was supposed to be the tool that we used to eat our food. Because your fingers radiate the energy in your body. Every part of your body has a natural order. You know, back then, ladies and gentlemen, our Vedamahatturu, the traditional doctors back in the day, they used to be able to heal simply by touch. By touch, they were able to heal. And they knew exactly which finger, because it was all part of the teaching. It was part of that medical knowledge. This finger was there for one thing, this finger was there for something else, this finger was there for something else, this for another, and this for another. Therefore, when you mix your food with your fingers, there's an interaction that happens between you and your food, and it prepares the food in a way that makes it ready for your body. So today is not about anicca dukkha anatta, I'm afraid. I didn't come here to give this lecture to you, but this is what it has become. Just like your mouth and the teeth in your mouth prepares your food for digestion, the fingers prepared your food for digestion. There was an energy that came out, that you emanated from your body. Because what is food after all? It's energy as well. So now you understand this stuff. It's an interaction of energy. So the energy that came out of your fingers interacted with the energy that was the food, and it made it ready for your consumption. If you don't believe me, ask yourself, how come we have far more digestive problems and diseases and conditions than our ancestors did? Most of our ancestors, you know, all they had was a kanda koppe. That's all they had. Some kanda in the morning. It's a herbal drink. That's all they had. And that was all they needed. From head to toe, that would cure all their problems. And the rest of it was, they just left it to nature. But today we have completely, that I don't know, done something very different to ourselves. Now we put our food in the fridges, without any thought to what it does to the actual food, because it's energy after all. We think we understand. Just because science has revealed something to us, we think that's the best way to do it. I'm not suggesting that you know, you throw your fridge out and, you know, put it in honey or something, like our ancestors used to do, or put it in the earth. That's not what I'm suggesting. But all I'm saying is, you know, we often take these wrong turns, many wrong turns along the way, yet we call ourselves the intelligent race. So many mistakes we make only because we think we know what is right always. And we just import whatever someone else does. So fridges and freezers were not designed for us because we didn't need that, because we had the farms and the paddy fields and the sun and the rain. We didn't need to store our food for days and weeks and months. There were barns that in which they kept the grain. That storage was done. Today we eat a lot of leftovers. Actually, it's just decaying food. That's what you put into your bodies. Sometimes some food a month old, 2 months old, 3 months old, 4 months old, sometimes maybe even up to a year old. But you deep freeze it and then you think it's all fine. Good. As long as it's deep frozen, it's good. Defrost it, cook it, eat it. With little understanding as to the impact that it has on your bodies. So why am I saying any of this to you? No point really, is there? I'm just wasting your time. Because it's not like you can now go and just unplug your fridge and throw it out. You have to continue using it. You have to use your freezer, you have to use your toaster, you have to use your cooker, you have to use everything. And you have to also eat your food with your cutlery. But I tell you, if you want to live another 2 years, another 5 years, if you want to live another 5 years longer, so you can actually do something with your lives, if today you eat your food with your cutlery, I suggest to you, this is only a suggestion, not a rule, switch to using your hands. Suggestion, only a suggestion. Possibly. Yeah, there will be various tests you can find. But I think the real testimony was our ancestors. That is a real testimony. They were much healthier than we were, and you have to admit that. Yeah, we've lived long enough and we have lived. We are old enough to have spent time with our grandparents, most of you, who were two or three generations before the, you know, what we call Gen Z. And they had a healthier lifestyle to us. So if you went back a few more generations, they were even healthier. I'm just talking about one simple change. If you don't use your hand today to eat your food, I suggest to you, this is only a suggestion. And, you know, if you don't have a problem, like say you have arthritis or some other problem, if you can manage to mix your food and eat it, I suggest you use your hand. When you have to switch to cutlery, do that. You know, maybe if you're at a party or you're at some kind of a place where it's not acceptable to use your fingers, fair enough. Then you do that. But at home, when you're comfortable, when you're just with your own people and when no one's there to judge you, okay? I suggest you. But of course, wash your hands. You must wash your hands, and for that there are good hand washing techniques. So you must wash your hands, make sure they're clean, and then eat your food with your hand. I'll guarantee you 5 extra years. One for each finger. I promise you 5 extra years on the lease for free. See, one sermon gave you 5 extra years. How good is that? Come back next Sunday, I'll give you another 5. So I was saying, as I was being driven in this morning, I thought, exercise is something we all need. Fair enough. But people have glorified these necessities that we have to do to sustain ourselves. People have glorified that. Like food, it's a necessity, but people have glorified that. They have ceremonified, is that a word? Ceremonialized? Okay, that one. People have ceremonialized. Ceremonialized. Ceremony, yes, yeah. So they have made a ceremony out of it, is what I want to say. So whatever the word is for that, that's the word I'm thinking of. So whether it's ceremonialization or ceremonification or whatever. Huh? Yeah, so basically food is a necessity to keep us alive. But do you think that humans have kept it at a bare necessity? Or have we not glorified it to become something far more than that? That's what we've done. It's become something more than a bare necessity. It's become a feast. It's become a party. It is what I'm saying is, you know, this is like a funeral. At the funeral, actually, this is an interesting point. You answer my question. What good is the funeral to the dead man? What good is a funeral to the dead man? What if you do a grand one? Casket made out of oak and velvet insides. The finest cushions. Air conditioned. For a good ride. Maybe we can even put shock absorbers so that when they lower it into the grave, right, any shocks will be absorbed and it will not be transferred to the corpse. Let's do a grand, a really proper grand funeral. With like lights and balloons, and I don't know, you bring balloons to a funeral, but let's say we went the extra mile, you know, the full bells and whistles. Okay, horse carriage, yes, horse carriage, why not? So it's not just a standard hearse, it's the horse. There are horses. Okay, horses, elephants. What else shall we bring? And the rest, right? So my question is this: what good is a grand funeral to the dead man? Zero, isn't it? I mean, to the dead man, you can't even. There's not even the show off part. The show off is for the people who are trying to make the most of the dead man. That's for the people who, the rest of the family, they're trying to make the most of this man's death. So first they wait for the life assurance to cash in their check, and then it's the show off part. So anyway, that's a story for another day. But the funeral is of no value to the dead man. I'll tell you what is of value. If maybe after 7 days you do some almsgiving and transfer some merits to the dead man, that is of use. But the funeral itself is of zero value. Likewise, the party that you throw because you have to take a meal, what good is that to the body? What good is that to the body? See, the body needs food, the body needs exercise, the body needs clothing to keep itself safe from the elements, okay? To protect it from insects and all sorts, from the heat, from the cold, from you know, the wet weather and so on. For that, the body needs what we call necessities. These are the requisites, as we call them. But the party that goes alongside that, now, take what's going on outside, as I said earlier. Initially, that was supposed to be exercise. Because exercise is a necessity for the human body. Then what happened? They introduced competition into exercise. When you introduce competition into exercise, now you get sport. It's no longer just exercise. Now it becomes sport. Granted, you know, I know some of you will think, well, Swami Nansa, there's more than just that in sport. You have leadership, you have self-management, you have, you know, how do you control your emotions and all the rest of it. Yes, but, you know, you don't always have to compete to develop leadership skills. You can become a good leader. Did Jesus have no leadership skills then? Did he have no leadership skills? Who did he compete with? Who did the Bodhisattva compete with? No one. Their only competition was with themselves. The Bodhisattva only competed with himself. He was his only... What's the word? The person you compete with? The competitor, yes. He was his only opponent. He was his only opponent. His self was the only opponent. And And he treated everyone with compassion. That's why I say compassion is the name of the game, not competition. So much so, in fact, I was talking to Sudhasihandru just before I walked up here. So I'll share with you what I told him. I said, Swaminathan sir, wherever you see competitive sport, competition of any nature, doesn't have to be sport. Wherever you see competition, in the classroom, at the workplace, on the grounds, wherever. Wherever you see competition, people earn demerit. I will tell you why. Let me explain to you why. Don't just take this for granted. Don't just take it because I said so. I want you to understand why. Take the 10 unmeritorious deeds. I ask you to focus on the last three, which are the three unmeritorious deeds that are wholly done by the mind. To outline the three of them, abhijja, vyapada, micchaditti. Micchaditti is false view. Vyapada is hatred, ill will towards others. And abhijja is this. Hear me out. Is to gain for yourself at someone else's expense. To gain at someone else's expense. To put it in very simple words, it's when you feel, I want something and I don't want others to have it. That is abhijja. What is it again? I want something which I don't want others to have. So I want to deprive others of something that I want for myself. Now tell me what competition is. What is competition? It is that. Competition is that. See, in competition, now let's take the game that's going on outside. When they score, you only see one team clapping, only one team applauding, and the supporters, the spectators, again are split in two groups, right? There's maybe like, say, usually they have the home team and the visitors, typically. But here it's no difference. They're all friends at school, I imagine. But in a typical game, take a game of cricket, for instance. When Sri Lanka plays, who did we pay the 96 World Cup? That's the only World Cup we ever talk about. We've not won anything ever since. Who did we pay? Australia. So, all of the spectators, I mean you, if you were there watching the game on the day at the time, whenever Sri Lanka scored, how did you feel? Elated, indeed. And when Australia scored, or they got a wicket, how did you feel? Sad, disappointed. You were not happy about that. Every score that was made, who did you want it to be? Whose did you want it to be? Sri Lanka's. Every wicket that was taken, whose did you want the wicket to be? Well, we got the wicket, but who lost the wicket? Australia, that's what you wanted. So really, what did you want when you watched that game? Victory at whose expense? The other side's expense. The Buddha calls it abhijja. It's an akusal. And people wonder why Nibbana is so difficult. I'm sorry, I'm not the maker of the rules, okay? I don't make the rules. I'm just here to show you that this is what's going on with your lives. See, today, I'm so blessed. I don't compete. I have no competition, I only have compassion. I don't compete. I don't have to compete. With whom? My only opponent is my sense of self. That is my only opponent. None of you here are my competitors, are my opponents. Assume there's someone who wishes ill health on me, someone who wishes the worst on me, someone who wishes to curse me. He is not my opponent. Because of course I understand today that whatever comes my way is my own doing. So how can he or she be held responsible? All I can think of is, now this man, he's doing what I did back then. He's sowing the same evil seeds that I once did. And if I can't help him today, then he's also going to be on the receiving end, just as I am today. So perhaps I can help him. Therefore, he's not my opponent. Please open your minds up to this, ladies and gentlemen. You've told me that you're open-minded. So please open your minds up and ask yourselves, is this the life that you want for yourselves? How much competition do you face on a day-to-day basis? Every single day. At the workplace, how much competition goes on? When your children go to school, how much competition goes on? I mean, you know, we interest them in sport and whatnot. Like I said, I fully support the exercise element of the sport. 100%. Because your body needs it. But the moment you introduce competition into that, now you're doing yourself more worse than good. That's what happens. And I'll tell you what happens to the spectators. Take the spectator. Let's say there's a ball of football and people are watching a game of football. Typically you watch it from home, or if you go to the stadium, you're there. I mean, anything, you know, horse racing, Formula One, boxing, wrestling, whatnot. Okay? So you're a spectator. Now, if you have set your eyes on one team or one individual and you want them to win, what do you want the others to lose? Let me tell you what the Buddha said. To sin is bad, and so is to encourage sin. It is also bad. You see, is doing merit good? Tell me, is doing merit good? What about rejoicing in others' merit? It's good, yeah? Sure? Okay, then is doing sin bad? Then what about rejoicing in others' sins? There you go. Whether you do bad, evil, or you cheer in that, you earn the same demerit. Okay, if you're not ready to accept the same, okay, 90% of the demerit. 10%, let you off. At least the people on the ground, the players on the ground, they're getting some exercise out of it. What are you getting out of it? Only the demerit. At least the drivers, you know, the Formula One drivers, right, they get a good paycheck at the end of it. Right, out of their sponsorships and whatnot. What do you get? You spend your hard-earned money to get there, to watch it, and then at the end of that, you walk out with a lot of demerit. Sin, no? Sorry? Yes. The good lady is asking about when people go to watch wildlife. And then how that is to be understood. I'll talk about that another time. Okay? Oh, yeah. That's why, you remember once I taught you how to enjoy a good game of cricket. Right? You can't take a party. You can't take a side. I think the only one who earns any merit, if at least the one who doesn't earn any demerit, is the umpire. And in a game of football, where the umpire doesn't get any exercise, he's just standing in one place. But a game of football is good, because if the referee has to keep running around the field, not so much, but the referee's running around the field, and he gets paid for that, and he's supposed to not take a side. So he doesn't wish for one team to win and for another to lose. Therefore, he doesn't earn any demerits in that regard, and he gets a good exercise. I think he's the one who should be looking at when you watch a game of football and rejoice. So instead of focusing on the players, try and spot the referee. He transports the referee and goes, sadhu, sadhu. No, but on a serious note, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I'm not just sharing these things with you for a, you know, for a joke and a laugh, okay? This is serious stuff. All right, now listen. Shush. Commentaries later. This is serious stuff. I mean, there are worse things, like when people watch wrestling. Wrestling? Yeah? Wrestling. Wrestling. And these combat sports. All these martial arts. Then there's boxing and all these sports. When you watch those sports, people rejoice when someone else is hurt or attacked. You might think this is just entertainment, but let's be honest. Let's be honest. Even if it were entertainment on the screen, I think they used to have WWF and then they changed it to WWE to suggest that it's not proper wrestling and it was just entertainment. That is the story. I don't know whether there's any truth in that, but that's what I was told when I was younger. But when you watch these combat sports, what you really rejoice is when one person attacking another. Fair enough, they're both consented. Yeah, so it's not war. It's not a battle, but it's still violence. Is it not? It's still violence nonetheless. So to inflict violence upon one another is sinful. I don't think there's any doubt there about that. But then to be the spectator who rejoices in that is also sinful. Why do you put yourselves through that? Why do you put your children through that? I mean, what hope of Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, then? The moment you introduce competition into something, that's why at our school, at Noble International School, we have no competition. There's no competition. We give children exams, we get their results, but we never announce who's first in class, second in class, third in class. No one finds out, no one gets to know, because that is not what they're there for. I know, in the world outside, this is a necessary evil. I understand. Because there are only so many places at university. So exams have to be competitive by design. Therefore, if you know that there's only one place and you and another boy in class or another girl in class, she's also very smart, right? And she's a strong competition to you. Deep down, what are you wishing? That she won't make it. You might pass the exam, you might get your place at university, but you have lost your chance at Nibbana. Meaning, you have to be born again to do your A-levels again. And then be born again to do your scholarship exams again, and O-levels again, and everything again, and find a job again, and train yourself again. Seriously? Just think about the price that we pay. I know what I'm throwing like these, you know, bombs at the way that society works. I'm completely tearing up the fabric of society and the social norms and the way that the systems are designed and everything. But my purpose here is not to nourish and nurture and further society's ways and means. I don't want to disrupt them. I just want to leave them aside and exit. And among you will be a few who also would like to come along with me. And to them I make an invitation. I don't think it's healthy to put your children through competition. I don't think so. They might come out first. And you might disguise it in the name of leadership to be able to bear loss. To be able to bear loss, the only thing you need to understand is there's no loser and there's no winner. They're both the same. For that, you just need the Dhamma. That is what you need to understand. The Buddha said, Jayang Verang Pasavati. When there's a loser, when there's a victor, the loser has hatred towards the victor. And when there's a victor, the victor is always in fear that they may lose their position, that they may lose their hard-earned victory. Every time we win something, we are always in fear, aren't we? That we might lose it. You can never be free of that fear because there's always going to be another round. Every year they'll have a competition, and that the next one, you have to still fight. Last year's victory does not guarantee a victory this time. Therefore, every year you have to keep fighting for it, and you have to keep working on it. Therefore, no victory is a permanent victory. So all victories are very temporary, except for one victory, the victory over oneself. That is permanent. No one can take it from you. And the day that you are free from yourself, you have won that, you don't need to face any of these other competitions. I'll tell you why people compete. Because their lives are miserable. They're not happy. Because they're not happy, they put themselves through a kind of competition and hope that they can come out top. And when they come out top, after all that hard work, you know what happens when there's vexation? There's relief from vexation, and that relief gives them a sense of pleasure. That's what they're going for. That's why once what was only done for exercise was later malformed with a sense of competition, and now actually people are doing it for the competition. Little of it is actually done for the actual exercise element. I gave you the example of the football match, a game of football. How many players? 11 per team. Yeah, so 22 people on the ground, running around. They get the exercise. The referee earns some merits. The rest of them earning demerits. And what about the spectators, the thousands and the hundreds of thousands of spectators? They're munching away into their burgers, sipping away into their soft drinks, with bellies the size of houses, right? And they get nothing out of it. Usually a brawl before they go back home. That's what they usually get. Or being slammed by a chair or something. And sometimes maybe even trodden to death. This is what they get. So no merit out of it. They've spent their money buying a ticket to be there. No exercise out of it either. So what do spectators get out of sport? You tell me and I will come with you to the next game. Honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I am telling this to you because I care about the way you spend your time and I want you to be happy. You are going after these meaningless pursuits that will not bring you any sense of satisfaction. I have to refer you back to that syringe. You are filling your minds up with just nothing. How could you be happy? So this is only, you know, if you want to get to the Nibbana, think about what I've just shared with you today. And you ask yourself whether you want to continue to be a spectator of competitive sport. You ask yourself that question. You don't have to come and tell me what you want to do from here on. It's totally up to you. I'm only here to show you the facts. You decide. I'm only here to open the book of Dhamma. Because you can't read it by yourself. Because you haven't committed and devoted yourself enough to understand the scriptures. That takes a while. So I'm opening the book up to you. I'm deciphering the Dhamma for you. Because in a scripture you can't understand. You can read the letters but you can't understand the essence of it. Not without a teacher. That's what I'm doing for you. I'm deciphering the Dhamma for you. And then I'm sharing it with you. And then you have to think. You have to analyze. You have to reflect. Reflect on your own lives. Take the Dhamma, reflect on your own lives. Take a little bit more Dhamma, reflect on your own lives. Take a little bit more Dhamma, reflect on your own lives. Always reflect on your own lives. Nothing else, nothing more. And then ask yourself the question, am I doing the right thing? Is this serving me right? Otherwise, let's go up to the Buddha and say, Buddha, why did you put that one into the unmeritorious list? Can you just strike it out or something? Let's put something else in there. Let's go and make a deal with the Buddha. Because in the 10 unmeritorious deeds, where he had pranadipata, adinnadana, kamesumichachara, musavada, pisunavaja, parushavaja, zampraprapralapa, abhijjavyapada, michaditti. These are your 10 unmeritorious deeds. Each of these earns you demerit, which goes into your karmic strand. Just as each of the merits go into your karmic strand, each of the demerits also go into your karmic strands. So then when it's time to ripen, who do they come and punish? Not me. You. So don't do it on my account or don't do it on my behalf. You do what is right for you. I'm only here to show you what's right and wrong. That is what I was thinking as I was driven into the school this morning. I feel for those children. I hope and I pray that they're only doing it out of love and compassion, and you know, they're just doing it for exercise. That makes me feel better when I think that. I can sleep easy when I think that. But when I forget that and start reflecting on what reality might be, and then when I see that they only clap when the ball is thrown into one of the rings and not the other, then I realize there's competition going on. And the moment I see there's competition going on, then I know they're earning demerit. Because I want to succeed at someone else's loss. But see how we have glorified that? People are applauding. There's drinks, there's music, there's a crowd. Everyone's come. They've invited their families. Even Achi Amma must be there. Poor Achi Amma. No, she's just on her, nearing the end of her life. Right? Hopefully she can earn a few more merits before she's gone. But now what has she brought into observe witness? Does Achi Amma get any merit, get any exercise out of this? No, the only thing that happens to her is when she sees her grandson or granddaughter running to score, she's happy. I mean, she doesn't know what the heck's going on, so someone has to tell her. Oh yeah, granny, when Dua takes that ball and throws, it was run there, put into that ring, you have to be happy. And you clap. So she can't even clap. Maybe someone has to bring her hands together and do one of those. But now she's been indoctrinated to think that her daughter wins when they put a ball through that ring. But then she asks, what about when the ball goes to the other ring? No, that's not good. Not good. Not good for your daughter. Not good for the granddaughter, that. Now then she's unhappy. Really, if she's unhappy, then I must be 10 times unhappier for her. Because if I love my daughter, then I love my granddaughter 10 times as much. Surely, at least 2 times as much. So if my granddaughter's unhappy, then surely I'm very unhappy. So whenever the ball goes into the other ring, now poor Achi Amma, she could have just stayed at home, listened to some pirito or something. They brought her to watch the game. So she's looking at that. She doesn't even understand what this game is. All she knows is if the ball goes in that ring, my granddaughter is unhappy. So now she has to be unhappy. So now she doesn't want the other team to win because she wants her granddaughter's team to win. Does she get exercise? No. What does she get? Demerit. That's it. Abhijja. But there's music. It's a celebration. It's a celebration. That is why I said to you earlier, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we must have, as human beings, we need to exercise. Not that exercise. We need to exercise our intelligence. We need to have association of noble friendship. Noble association. Because otherwise none of these things become obvious to us. That's why I say, right from the classroom, right from nursery, children are taught to be competitive. From nursery all the way to your where you're going to be laid when you're dead. Because even that people compete for. They want the best plot of land. I want that plot of land. How much for that? Someone else has already put in an offer. I will double it. People pay top price, premium prices to be put in a premium spot. You can pre-order your casket, your vehicle, your kit, your makeup, the music they play. No, then you can. The Swamin Mahan says who are going to arrive. Then the shoes they are going to put on you. You can pre-order all of these things. In fact, you can go to the funeral parlor and you can have a good feel for the material, the texture, and select which one you want to, you know, line the insides of your casket, your coffin. You can choose it in advance. See how intelligent we are? And you can even choose the wood and the scent that they spray after they put you in there. Whether you want like rose or jasmine or some other, something a bit more masculine, like if you are a male, or something with a bit of feminine touch, if you're a female. You can do that. And the band, sorry? Yeah? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, the feast, yes.
Celebrations.
Celebrations, yeah. Obituary. Ah. Ay. So, what I feel for is this human race. I mean, where are we going? Who have we become? Where did we lose the plot? What's going on? People have no idea. One blind man being led by another. All this while, you're spending your hard-earned merits to have been born human. This is an opportunity for all of us to achieve our salvation. But look at how we waste our time doing just nonsense, ladies and gentlemen. Computer games are just another part of the whole thing. Even in computer games, true, there isn't an actual opponent, but there's still a virtual opponent. So even if there's a virtual opponent, you still have the competitive spirit. So let's say you have an avatar, and then there's another virtual avatar, and that's the computer playing against you. I mean, just take a simple game of chess. On the computer, you're playing chess on the computer. There's no other person, but there's some other entity. It's not a person, that's it. It's not a person, but there's another entity. You will call it the computer. You want to win at its or their loss. Wherever you have this competitive spirit, don't think that you're earning merit or you're earning demerit. Wherever there's a competitive spirit. Whether you want to become richest, biggest, prettiest. See, young girls these days, young boys, you know, children, they are put to these competitions. Singing competitions, dance competitions, fashion competitions, all sorts. We are not here to compete with each other. Honestly, that is very animalistic to compete. Humans are not supposed to compete. Humans are supposed to care and share. Give what they have to others. Give every opportunity to others. Support others. Lend a helping hand. Give a hand so that others can stand up. Not compete. Share. Care. When you do that, you become a deva. Because to deva is to denna, is to give. That's when you can rise up from humanness up to devanness or even brahmanness. To become a brahma, you have to exceed even the deva qualities. Then you have the satara brahma viharana, the four brahmic abodes, metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha. Slightly below that is the Deva mindset. And below that is the human mindset. That is why these 31 realms of existence are structured in that way. And then even below that is the animal mindset. And below that is the Preta and so on. So the further up you go, the more you care about others. The further down you go, the more you care about who? Yourself. What is competition? Caring about myself. My success, my team's success, my family's success, my people's success, my country's success. See, before every word is the word my. Doesn't that nurture the self? Wherever you're talking about my, aren't you talking about myself? See, now you're nurturing the self. So, I want you to be aware of this. Be mindfully aware of these situations. These are not hard and fast rules for anyone. I'm not imposing myself on you, I hope. I hope you don't feel that way. I'm only opening your eyes, ladies and gentlemen. You have to decide what's right for you. If you still feel Swaminarayan is just speaking nonsense, it's just a bunch of gobbledygook, right? That's fine. Put it to a side. You do what you think is right. So if you ever feel that this is just nonsense, you know, what is Swaminarayan talking about? It makes no sense at all. Competition is part of our lives. It is what helps us develop our leadership skills, our tolerance, and our competitive spirit, and to help others and whatnot. I don't think so. Personally, I don't think so. At the monastery, we have no competition, but we have plenty of compassion. We have plenty of compassion. We don't have to compete to look after each other. You know, if there was another monastery, okay, if there was another monastery, if there was another sermon somewhere in Rajagiri or in somewhere in Colombo, somewhere else, where you feel that that Nibbana was presented to you, taught to you better, and in a way that was more practical, in a way that is more relatable to you, you don't have to come here. Honestly. I don't want you. I just want your salvation. I don't want you to be here. I want your salvation. If your salvation happens when you're at home, then don't come here. Be at home. If your salvation happens when you go and do another degree, do that. If your salvation happens if you earn more money, work the weekends, then do that. If your salvation happens when you go and spend time with your friends, then you must do that, ladies and gentlemen. Whatever it is. But you know that none of those things worked for you. You did all of those things. Your salvation didn't happen. That's why you're here today. So please open your minds and think about what I've just talked to you about. This competitive spirit is a killer. It erodes your Nibbana, trust me. Not trust me, understand. Don't just trust, but understand, be convinced. Competition erodes your Nibbana. It erodes your practice. Sometimes you will come here on a Sunday, listen to all this, realize, oh gosh, I understand the sense of self is complete, you know, this is chaos. I have to really free myself from it. You go back home and watch the golf or watch some sport on TV. And then if Sri Lanka is playing or some player that you like is playing, you go, yeah, that's it, get it, that's it. And you're cheering for them. So whenever you're cheering, what you're saying is, may they win at the other's loss. Why they? Because that's the party that you like. That means whose victory are you really cheering for? Whose victory? Not them on the TV. Not them on the field. Whose victory? Your own victory. Because you have a sense of self. Therefore, all that contemplating that you did here is completely and entirely eroded after you spend 2 hours in front of the TV watching a competitive sport. How do you get to Nibbana then? You know, it's like this. And then next Sunday, You're happy because you keep two steps forward every Sunday. Yes. But three steps back every other day. So, 3 times 6, 18 steps back, and 2 times 1, 2 steps forward. 2 steps forward, 18 steps back. And you want Nibbana. I know that you're not to blame for this, because you have been indoctrinated by the people that you have been spending your lives with. It is what they say on TV. It's what's on the TV guide. It's on the brochures. It's on the adverts. It's what people want you to do. But it's a fool's paradise. Don't you become a puppet to the world's puppeteers. If you want Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, don't you become anyone's puppet. You've got to think for yourself. Think with your own intelligence. Understand what is right and wrong for you. And don't even take what I say as gospel truth. Contemplate. Is Swaminarayan making sense? He gave us a lecture, but does this actually make sense? This is what he says, right? Go and find out what the Buddha taught. I mean, even if you ignore the abhijja as an unmeritorious deed, right? Let's just ignore that abhijja as an unmeritorious deed. Don't you agree with me that whenever you have this competitive nature, it nurtures the self? Can't you agree with me on that? Whenever you have the competitive spirit, does it not nurture the self? Why does it nurture the self? Because whose side do you want to win? Whose side? My side. If you say my side, then there is my, then there is I, then there is sense of I. So, of course it nurtures the self. I mean, nurtures the self. But what is the Dhamma asking you to do? Not to nurture the sense of self, to eradicate the sense of self, to exterminate the sense of self, to uproot the sense of self. So you see how these two are at odds with each other? That's why Guru Handra always asks, Gihivataka sita nivandakinne keseda? How can you get to Nibbana by living the lay lifestyle? Because in a lay lifestyle, you are framed and you are cushioned and you are put into this environment. You are immersed in an environment of total self-nurturing, self-development, self-growth, self-nourishment. It's a selfish world. That is what the whole lay lifestyle is centered around, the self. The monastic lifestyle is centered around selflessness. That is why if you can spend as much time in a monastic environment, in a monastic lifestyle, that eats away at your sense of self. It digs away at your sense of self. Every day you spend outside that environment, it feeds your sense of self. Hence, our invitation always, come. Come and join us. Whether it is by becoming a monk, or an anagarika, or a sila sravika, or a sila vaisi, or a sila sravaka, or even as an upasaka or a upasika who comes to the monastery once or twice a week. Even if it's in that context, if that is how far you can go, whenever you're on the noble path, you're getting to Nibbana. Whenever you're on the ignoble path, you're getting to the world. So this competitive spirit is the source of gravity. That is what I explained to you. What does gravity do? Pull you down. What is a competitive spirit? The spirit to pull others down. So what you give is what you get. So when everyone has this, collectively as a race, as a species, as a sentient beings, we all have this nature within us to, for our gain at others' loss, what we put out to the universe is always a force of pulling and dragging down. Therefore, today we have to fight and grapple with gravity. You can't even stand up on your own two feet without gravity always pulling on you. Therefore, even that requires exertion. You can't go anywhere. See how difficult it is to get from here to the washroom? How many steps must you take? Just assume if there was no gravity. To be very simple, just assume there was no gravity. Then you could just fly. You wouldn't have to walk. You would not need to exert energy for that. And then to exert energy, what must you do? You have to take energy in. To take energy in, isn't that a whole new ball game? That you have to go. As a race, we have to cultivate. We have to work with the earth, cultivate. And we have to wait for the crops to grow. And then when there are, pests. When there are pests, you have to do what you have to do to save your crop, which is again even more demerit as you do it. And then you get your harvest, and then you can't just stick it in your mouth. You have to still go through another process to process it. And then you have to go to the shops, you have to buy that stuff, you have to bring it home, you have to cook it, and then you have to keep it from going off. And after that you have to serve it, mix it, put it in your mouth, you have to masticate, and then you have to swallow it, you have to digest the whole thing. See, just to keep yourself upstanding, how much effort you need to put in. This is the punishment. For what? Competition. For trying to gain at others' expense. That is why this word, manussa, it has a nice etymology. Mana is to measure. Ussa is to raise, to lift. To measure, to gauge, and then to lift, to raise. What that suggests is, it is in our inherent nature to gauge ourselves among our peers, among people who live amongst us, and then to lift ourselves above them. And what helps in that process is to suppress them further as much as you can. You know, it happens at the workplace. When you want to get somewhere, what does everyone else at your level try and do? They pull you down. They pull you by the leg. Metaphorically, they pull you down. They don't want you to rise up. Unfortunately, we grow up experiencing all this and learning from society, and we think that is the right way to do business. If you are in business and you have a shop and there's another shop just on the other side of the street, right? And you see a customer walking up, a prospective customer, which shop do you want them to go to? Whose shop? Your shop, naturally. Why? Because you want a gain at someone else's loss. Whereas true noble thinking should be, wherever they can benefit, wherever the customer can benefit, may the customer go there. Very seldom I have seen some people, I don't know whether they're genuine or not, but I like to assume that they're genuine. If a customer comes up to them and they say they don't have what it is they need, then they will be so keen to prompt them, to lead them, to guide them to another place. Mahatma, if you go to that shop, I'm sure they'll have it for you. Would you like me to go and get it for you? I have seen that kind of service from a few places. But is that commonplace? Hardly do you see that. Would you be happy to talk to your girlfriend and say that? You know, if you're not getting what you want from me, I know a nice bloke, right? He's such a gentleman. If you want, I'll introduce him to you. Shall I talk to him on your behalf? What are you, Vesantara? Who does that? No, because we can't be interested in their interest. Why is that? Because we are far too embroiled and engaged in our own interests. That's why. That is selfful thinking, not selfless thinking. Our gain at another's loss. Because of that, we create an environment. We have created a world in which everything just drags us down, and hence gravity. Your physics teacher will teach you how gravity works, whether it's a capital G or a simple G, and it will tell you at 9.9.8 times 10. No. What is the acceleration? 9.8 meters per second squared. Thank you. At 9.8 meters per second squared, that is the force of gravity, acceleration of gravity. That they will tell you. But they will not be able to tell you where it all started. Why we have gravity in the first place. And they'll tell you because the earth rotates, it creates a force, and that force continues to sustain gravity. But why is the earth rotating in the first place? But when you start looking through the lens of cause and effect, and where all causes originate from ignorance and attachment, I mean, that is how we are able to look at all this and give you these explanations, but not magic, it's logic. You just have to understand that all creation, okay, remember that, all creation is an origin in ignorance. All creation. Where there is no ignorance, there is no creation. That is why you are the creator. You are the creator. Like I said, with every chitta, there are three paths for energy to flow. One is to your karmic strand, the other is to your physical body, and the third is to the environment. This cycle, it keeps on feeding itself. It's a self-sustaining cycle because ignorance and attachment remain in each thought. Therefore, it feeds itself. It's a recycling, self-sustaining cycle. That's why an Arahatan Vahansa is born. There is no ignorance, therefore there is no attachment. Therefore, there is no feeding the karmic strand. There's an element of energy that goes to the body, but what is released to the environment is pure. It has no desire to form anything, because all formation is essenceless, is the understanding of the Rahatan Vahansa. Therefore, they have no desire to form anything. That's why the Rahatan Vahansa says, Kina jati, usitam brahmacharya, na parangit tattayati pajanati. And he also says, I'm merely consuming my previous karmas, but I have ceased generating new ones. Kinam puranam navan natti sambhava. Puranam is what has already been generated. Kinam is to consume, to exhaust. Shekaranam is to exhaust. So I exhaust what has already been produced, but navan natti sambhava. Navan is new. Sambhavang is to produce. Natti sambhava is to cease producing, cease production. I don't produce anything new. Because all creation is rooted in ignorance. So who's the creator? Who's the creator? The ignorant mind is the creator. That is why I say you are God. If God is the creator, then you are God. I'm not talking about that God. Let that God be. I'm talking about you, the God. If you are the creator, then creation only happens in an ignorant mind. Because it is an ignorant mind that takes interest in something. And when interest is formed about something, now the mind works to aggregate energy to create it. Agreed? That's how creations happen. So if there was something or someone that created this earth, then there was some desire for this earth to be. The oceans, the mountains, the hills, the lakes, the rivers, the trees, the animals, there was some desire for these things to be. So when there's a desire to be, what happens next? Now we understand the mechanism. Now there has to be a force that attracts energy to create these formations. That is tanha. Attachment. That's why it's called attachment. It attaches energy to the structure. That is what it does. And voila, you have creation. So you are the creator. See how much credit I give you all? You are all creators. What marvelous creators you are. Look at how well you have created your bodies. all the punishment you give yourself. You have to bear your weight on your two legs. You have to carry your weight around on your two feet. You can't. I was thinking this morning while I was having alms this morning, how misfortunate we are. How dumb we must have been. The sun is radiating an abundance of energy. Isn't it? Look at the plants. All they do is that. Don't they? And they can take in all that energy to form fruit and parts of their bodies. But look at how stupid we are. Look at the length that we have to go to. Why can't we also be solar panels? I mean, plants are solar panels, aren't they? Because they expose them to the solar energy and they take that energy and that's all they have to do. They don't have to digest. They don't have to do any of that nonsense, but look at what we have to do. Do you know why that is? Because plants don't need these five senses. That's why. But we were so stupid, so out of our minds, that we thought that it's so interesting to understand the world through our five senses, because these five senses give us all different things, don't they? They're all separate things, all different things. With the lack of understanding, thinking that color is in this, taste is in this, smell is in this, this texture is in this. That's what we thought. Therefore, to experience all that from these objects, what did we have to do? We had to create eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and bodies. Therefore, solar energy is not enough to create all that. Now you have to take solar energy and then mix it, match it with something else, reform it, restructure it, reorganize it. And that's why you need these digestive systems. How simple life would have been if you could have just stepped outside, look up at the sun, stay for 10 minutes, and we are fully recharged. How lovely that would have been. But no. Serves us right for being so stupid. Honestly, serves us right for being so idiotic, for being so stupid. Hence my call to you. Let's put a stop to this idiocy. Let's put a stop to this stupidness. Let's rise above our ignorance, ladies and gentlemen. You are the fortunate crowd. You are fortunate to hear these words. Don't you think so? When have you heard these words before? Which school? Which university? If you go to Harvard, do you think you can hear all this? If you go to MIT, do you think they'll teach you all this? Or to Yale, do you think they'll teach you all this? Or maybe Oxford or Cambridge, do you think you'll learn all this? Then who do you think are meritorious? People who are there or people who are here? Who have come to a sasana? Think about it. Now you have the truth. Now you understand how everything works. Now you understand why you are the creator. Therefore, I have empowered you. The Dhamma has empowered you just as much as it empowered me. You understand that everything is your own doing. Your suffering is your own doing. Therefore, your happiness is your own doing. Now take charge and do something about it while you still have your good life left with you. Don't just while away the days and the hours and the weeks and the months and the years and then finally your life. Don't let that go by. You won't get this chance again. Do you remember one word you learned in your previous life? Do you remember any one? Just give me one word you learned in your previous life. Do you? No. Therefore, every word you've learned in this life will also be forgotten no sooner than you shut your eyes. Remember this. I'll say this and we'll close for the day. I have another announcement to make, but remember this. Knowledge that is not put to action is as good as not having that knowledge in the first place. It's as good as that. It's like having a nice library at home of books that you have never read. I can see some people in the room like that. Nice library, well-stocked library. So if you have some guests, you can see, look at my library. All volumes, the full volume. From A to Z, all categorized alphabetically. They ask you a question about one of the things in the book. I haven't read it yet. About to. I will. This weekend, I'm going to read it. So you have been saying every weekend. The only thing that library does is take up space and is food for the termites. That's all that library does. Only knowledge that you have taken in and then put to action is of any use to you. So I have imparted knowledge. Taking action is for you. Now, then to pay for our sins, you built a granary in Dambulla. Why do I say to pay for our sins? Because I was born this way. What to do? If I hadn't been born with a body that needed to be fed, then you would not have had to build that place. Then we would not have had to stock rice. We would not have to cultivate. I would just be able to go outside and stand like this. But unfortunately, my idiocy got the better of me. My stupidity got the better of me. And I was born a human. Now I have a stomach to fill. I have a body to nourish. And I have to sustain myself until I die. And the same is, of course, true for all of us. The sasana is thriving, ladies and gentlemen. It's beginning to. It's certainly beginning to. We can see a very grand future for the sasana in the coming years. I don't know for how many of those years you and I will be around, but that's okay. It's not my Nibbana that I'm here for. Just as much as it's not your Nibbana that you are here for, it is for Nibbana. Nibbana is where we lose our sense of you and mine, isn't it? Nibbana is what we are here for. That is why I truly admire your selfless act of building that place. Because I think, you know, so there are some among you, maybe even most of you, who contributed to that. Currently you have no plan of how you might enter the sasana. I mean, that's just, wow. That is selflessness. Currently, at present, you have no plan as to, you don't see a future because it's practically not possible, for instance. Maybe you've gone past that age where it's, or you have too many responsibilities, where coming and taking residence at the monastery is but a dream. Yet, you thought, well, there are others who will benefit. Because Nibbana is not mine or someone else's. Nibbana is Nibbana. Nibbana is for chittas that seek salvation. And it is to nourish those minds, we have to also sustain the bodies. That is why it's incredibly generous of you all to have supported that venture. I truly admire that. I admire not the contribution necessarily or what we have built, but the intention behind it. That is just truly beautiful. I truly, you know, these are the things I rejoice. It's not what you have done, but why you have done it. That is really beautiful to me. It's like when a child brings you a drawing and you can't work out which way is up or down. And then they hand it to you. But you think that is the top, you are holding it right. And you're going, oh, nice, putha, beautiful. And the child goes, you're holding it the wrong way up. Then you say, yeah, well, if it's beautiful this much this way, just imagine what it must be if I hold it the right way up. So you try and say something to make his mind up. Because it's not what you have done, it's why you have done it. I always look for that. It's very beautiful. Sometimes people try and do the thing with the best of intentions, but they get it wrong. That's okay. I really don't mind that. Say, for example, you want to bring someone a glass of water. Someone's coughing, or their guts out. You want to bring them a glass of water, and on the way in, you slip and you fall. I'm not going to be the one who says, ayo. person. No. I'm not going to be the one to say that. I will admire the fact that they went all that way to bring the glass of water. And let's just say that that glass of water was impure, but the person who offered it had no idea about it. Maybe it was not clean. It was contaminated with something. And perhaps this person, before the water, was only coughing, but as soon as they took the water, they collapsed. That was because of the water. I don't want any of you to think, to feel guilty because of what you've done. We must not feel guilty about the outcomes of our actions. We must only feel guilt, if necessary, for the intentions of our actions. Never feel guilty for the outcome of your actions. Try and do something good, ladies and gentlemen, and if it's a complete disaster, rejoice still in why you did it. Honestly. I'm like that. Because what we take with us is not what we've done, but why we did it. And also, if someone tries to help you, and even if it's a complete flop, and perhaps even if what they try to do for you leads you to a greater demise or a loss than the one that you were in initially, still, you can teach them a lesson afterwards as to how they could have done it slightly differently and maybe it would have been better for both of you. But if you can take a moment to look at the intention with which they did it and admire that first, appreciate them for that. I think you know, that is the hallmark of nobility, I think. Dhamma comes after that, Nibbana comes after that. You need to have that humility and the ability to see past an action and look at the intention behind that action. Now, these are the things I want from you all. Anicchidukkhanatta, I'll explain to you someday, we'll understand, work it out. Paticchasamuppada, one day we'll work it out, don't worry. But these values, they are golden. Without them, there is no future. There is no Nibbana. There is no salvation. Nothing. Trust me. So, your efforts coming together and building that granary. In Dambulla, maybe you might never visit that place again. Perhaps you didn't even know that you would have a chance to visit that place. In our farm in Dambulla. I told you it was in Dambulla. You said, okay, wherever it is, Swami knows. If I said it was in Brisbane, wouldn't you still have done it? Yeah, because, well, it's for the sasana. Even if it had been on the other side of the world, you'd still have done it because it's not for you. That's what I mean. Because you know that for many of you who supported that project, you had no idea to be the beneficiary of the crop that grows in the paddy fields or to eat the rice that's going to be cooked there. And it's not like you don't have enough. You have plenty for yourselves. Therefore, your intention was for the betterment of humanity. It's for the prosperity of humanity. It's for everyone. These are the actions I tell you. These are the intentions that will one day reverse gravity. These are those actions that will reverse gravity. This world will not be void of gravity, but I'll tell you what will happen. You will be born if you are somewhere where there is no gravity. Because this world will still have to be for those who wish to excel at others' cost. So this world will always have to be there. The infernos will always have to be there. The purgatories will always have to be there because that is the place that feels home to them. What you sow is what you reap. No, I always get that wrong. What you reap is what you sow. So I think Gauramaghandru asked you to put the reserve the date in your diary. That'll be next Sunday. And I believe there was an announcement that went out asking for you to register or to at least confirm RSVP, the invitation. So on the day, there will be a procession, and the plan is to fill the granary up with rice that will be brought there from our devotees from across the land. There are many people like you now who all want to get to Nibbana. Sad, isn't it? This is a mission. What is the commission for this mission? Nibbana is your commission. Nothing else. We don't want anything else. We don't want fame. We don't want glory. We're not here for a name. Nothing. We don't want any other profit. I promise, you know, whenever you do one of these meritorious deeds, ladies and gentlemen, determine. It is not for name. It's not for glory. It's not for fame. It's only for salvation. Because everything else is at odds with salvation. If Nibbana is like this, name, fame, glory, wealth, beauty, all of these are perpendicular to that Nibbana. They clash. They are not parallel. Anya hillabu panisa, anya Nibbana gamini. One is the path to gain and another is the path to Nibbana. So always make that determination. Ditti Jukama, we did a sermon on that on one of the sermons at the monastery. The intention for clarity of sight, that is what Ditti Jukama is. It is the 10th meritorious deed. I think no matter how much I say, I'm still not content in my rejoicing of the good that you have done to build that place up and to get the rice mill. So on the day, there will be a procession and people will be bringing sacks of rice from, I think by the time you arrive there, it'll be there. But you will all have the opportunity to carry some rice into the granary and put it into the mill. So you will be able to be part of that process. So the rice that will be milled will then be used to prepare a Sambuddha Puja. So the first offering will be to Bhagyatun Vahanse, to our great teacher, the source of all this inspiration, the source of all this wisdom. Wisdom personified is how I would put it. So you'll all be able to take part in that. And it'll be Kiripindu Dane. So how a Kiripindu Dane is typically prepared is no water is used in the preparation of that meal. It is cooked in milk, coconut milk. You've heard of Sujata? The Situ Devi. What is that in English? Statesman? Stateswoman? So she, Sudata, she offered a Kiripindu Dana to the Bodhisattva because he was going to fast for the next 7 days as he had come out of his austerity and he'd realized that no amount of austerity is going to bring me my salvation. Then he'd renounced that austere practice. And then by this point he had come to this realization that there has to be something that is neither indulging in these luxuries or in putting myself through austere practice. Neither of these two paths is going to get me to my salvation. Wrongly today it has been interpreted as the middle of those two extremes. That is not what the path is. It's not neither there nor here. It's not the middle in that regard. It's Majjhima Patipada, meaning it's the medium. The medium to Nibbana does not mean medium in the sense of hot, cold medium, not that medium. Medium as in, how does sound travel? What does sound need? It needs a medium. With that meaning, there's a medium to Nibbana. That is Majjhima Patipada. There's a path to Nibbana. So he'd realized that at that point. There has to be a path to Nibbana and neither one of these two things is going to get me there. So when he was preparing himself to get ready for that contemplatory period, he was sat under a tree and it was Sujata's routine to come along once in a while and make this offering. And she thought that this was a Ruksha Devata, the tree god who had descended from the tree and sitting down, and he looked very pleasant in his demure, and she wanted to offer this to the Ruksha Devata. She thought, she didn't know that this was a Bodhisattva about to become a Buddha. But this offering was made with such devotion that it is said, ladies and gentlemen, that no one other than a Bodhisattva could have digested that and ingested that and still survived. It was so nutritious and so potent that there was so much energy in it, as it had to last him for the next 7 days. Sorry, not 7 days, 7 weeks. I beg your pardon. It was going to last him for the next 7 weeks. And you heard of the Satsatya, the 7 weeks after enlightenment. So he took no meal during that period. The food that sustained him was the offering that was made by Sujata. I'm sharing with you a part of the story so that when you do that, when you prepare that meal, you can rejoice in that great offering that was made back then. You're doing something symbolic. Well, so is the statue, that is also symbolic. But we can earn as much merit offering or worshipping at the statue as we do in front of the real Buddha. Because what is meritorious is what we have in our minds. It's not what happens in the outside. There's only a very little contribution of what happens from the outside. So that was the Kiripindu Puja that was made by Sujata. So on the Sunday coming, you can all be Sujatas. So change your names just for that Sunday. You'll all be Sujata. And the gentleman, Sujata. So all you Sujatas and Sujatas, do you know what Sujata means? Jata is birth. Su is good. A wholesome birth. That's what Sujata means. Jata is birth. A wholesome birth, a good birth. Which you have all been so fortunate to have. You have been born well. So you can all be Sujatas on Sunday. Take part in that ceremonial cooking of the first meal. And then you will also be able to, so you'll be able to offer it as a Buddha Puja. And the Mahasangha will also be cooked a meal using the remainder of that rice. And then you will be able to all offer Pindapate to the Swaminarayanas who will be present there on the day. In addition to the granary, there will also be a Koppara hut. I checked the word up on the dictionary, it's Koppara in English as well. Or Kopra, not Cobra. Kopra. Kopra? Kopra. Kopra. It's Kopra. So there will be a Koppara hut, which is basically dried coconut, deshelled, and it's going to be toasted, which will then be used in the production of coconut oil. So we now have a coconut oil mill at Dambulla, which you will also be able to get sight of, and you can also put some coconut in there and enjoy, take part in that wonderful production of oil. So we actually now at the monastery, we get really good cooking oil, which simply means it is healthier, which extends our lives long enough to achieve what we have come to the sasana to achieve. Because eating all this rubbish, sorry to say it that way, but it is what it is. Every meal, the way I see it is, the food that we have these days, it extends your life by a day and shortens it by a week. This is how I feel today's food is. Extends it by a day but shortens it by a week. No wonder we die so young in this day and age. But our devotees have been so kind. They understand the reason that we have come to this asana. Men and women and children of all ages. And they all want to contribute to this cause, this mission. And I think everyone understands that if the sasana is to flourish, then the Mahasangha should remain healthy both physically and mentally. So mental health is of course given to us by Guru Hamdro and our teachers through the Dhamma, but physical health, of course, we are dependent on the food we have and the medicines when we feel ill. So that's also going to happen on the Sunday. And then to put a cherry on the cake, Guru Hamdro will be there to talk to all of you and will remind us all the profoundness of that meritorious deed so that we can all rejoice in it. And this morning, just as I went and worshipped Guru Hamdro to take permission to leave the monastery, as I always do, he said, remind them all to come. That's what he said. He wanted me to personally invite all of you to the event on Sunday, because he said a lot of them will earn a lot of good merits if they are able to witness what's going on there. We will also have an opportunity to give you a tour of the Dambulla farm, which is where we cultivate a lot of our crop now. I think we hardly buy things from the shops nowadays. A lot of what we need is now cultivated. Again, no pesticides, no toxic whatevers. It's the good stuff, and we have the cattle farm there now. So they give us all the fertilizer we need. Our milk mothers, they give the fertilizer we need. So it's a very eco-sustaining, very healthy, a lot of compassion. And a lot of our Srila Sravaka Mahatyas and our Swaminvanses, they visit that farm alternating weeks, and they also get an opportunity to earn lots of merits while they're there. You might have seen pictures on social media and all sorts. Our Srila Sravaka Mahatyas, there's a Sasana Dasa program. This is currently only available to gents. But when you're there on Sunday, you will be able to see what they do and what they have done. So if any of you are interested in becoming a Sasana Dasa, what is a Sasana Dasa? What is Dasa? Dasa is a slave. Sasana is a Sasana. So, I'm a slave to the Sasana. Who was the first slave to the Sasana? Not me, don't look at me. The very first slave to the Sasana was the Buddha. He spent 45 years of his life in complete slavery. Complete slavery, that's what he did. He carried his teacher on his shoulders everywhere he went. Who was his teacher? The Dhamma. From door to door, city to city, town to town, village to village, person to person, human worlds, deva worlds, brahma worlds, he went everywhere carrying his teacher on his shoulders, introducing his teacher to every soul that he came across. That is the epitome of slavery to the Sasana. We can't be like him. He's matchless. So that's what Guru Hamdro is doing now, to the best of his ability. That is what our Swaminvanses, who are spread across the globe right now, taking the Dhamma to them, are doing. Slavery to the Sasana. Bhikkhus are slaves of the Sasana. Servants of the Sasana, if you like. You're also servants of the Sasana. So when you visit Dambulla, you can partake in that meritorious event. And then on the 4th, which is Tuesday, following that Sunday, there will be the event, a ceremonial event at Andigama, which is in Chilau. Again, you are welcome, I think, but they need numbers, so please register yourselves if you haven't already. So that will be a paddy land. It has not been cultivated for some time, but on the day, it's now been cleared, and we will cut the first sod while we are there. Our Mahasangha will be present there. Guru Hamdro will be attending that as well. And you're all invited to be there. So that is where we will grow some of our paddy, and then we'll bring it to Dambulla, and we will process it, and then we'll bring it to Ingiriya. and then we will cook it, and then we'll feed everyone, and then we'll come to Rajagiriya, and we'll take you to Ringiriya, and we'll feed you some of that as well. So that's happening on the 4th. So 2nd and 4th, if you can reserve those dates in your diaries, I think it will serve you very well. So because we need numbers, ladies and gentlemen, registrations are closing tomorrow. So you have between now and the end of tomorrow to make known, to register yourselves. There's a WhatsApp group where all of this activity happens. So if you are not a member of that WhatsApp group, I invite you to register. I think, I don't know where you can get details of that. Is it? You can ask Madam Tushita. If you are not already a member of the WhatsApp group, you can get your details on there. And it's a one-way communication. We've designed it that way so that you're not spammed and you're not, your numbers are not advertised. And it is in the name of security and confidentiality. So you will be informed about events. You can, of course, I think you can put reactions to those things, but not to reply. But I think it's been very useful in that regard, because a lot goes on at the monastery, and this WhatsApp group has enabled us to share a lot of the going-ons with all of you as well. Okay, let's leave it there then. I promise to share with you the precepts, meaning of the precepts. I'll do it another week then. Now that you're all Sakudagamis, right? You're all now Sakrudagamis. Now the next thing I have to do is to make you an Anagami by explaining to you the third precept. Okay. Let's take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma, as well as inviting the Swami to deliver the sermon. First and foremost, let us take a moment to transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, as well as the Mahanayakas, Yanunayakas, Theras, of all the chapters throughout the world who have dedicated and sacrificed their lives to fulfill and further some of the sasana. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who provide your know-how and extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers, sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers and anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadevas, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer our merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this merits to those who passed away in our name, our forefathers, our ancestors, our grandparents, and so on. Reminding ourselves that it is in the blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer this merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives for the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who commit themselves to the prosperity of our nation, its security and its well-being and the well-being of all its citizens. Let us transfer merits to all of them. Let us also transfer merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe. Let us also transfer our merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, siblings to us, friends of ours, individuals who have gone out of their way to make our lives that much better. And therefore, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all of them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of the merits, they abstain themselves from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a rahatan vahanse or an arahateranin vahanse in this very life itself, and certainly in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnang idatnva dvesha ginnang idatnva moha ginnang Nidatnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetnva මම ද සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝ නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා රාග ගිනි නිවේවා ද්වේෂ ගිනි මෝහගිනි නිවේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා නිවන් සැප ලැබේවා තුනුරුවන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්ත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු, සාදු, සාදු.